Today is Tuesday, December 7th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedu Afo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, efforts to de-escalate tension in Ukraine tops agenda of Presidents Biden and Putin's video call.
Important one is Ukraine.
Plus, Morocco and Israel defense ministers formalizing security relations.
The Israelis are agreeing to help across the board from training counterinsurgency.
Also, the WHO reports significant rise in malaria cases and deaths in 2020 due to COVID-19 disruptions. Our top story today is in the U.S. An effort to de-escalate tension in Ukraine was on top of the agenda as President Joe Biden held the much-anticipated video call with Russian President Vladimir Putin. A senior U.S. official said Biden warned Putin of severe economic consequences should Russia go ahead with a threatened invasion of Ukraine. Analysts also said Biden pressed Putin on the massing of thousands of Russian troops on the border with Ukraine and support for separatists fighting government forces in the eastern part of the country. Ukraine says more than 94,000 Russian troops have gathered near its border. Russia says its troops' deployments are a response to aggressive behavior by Ukraine and NATO, which it does not want to expand further eastward. For more on their talk, I spoke with VOA White House Bureau Chief Patsy Widaskuwara.
So according to the White House, the meeting started at 10:07 a.m. on Tuesday morning, and there are several items on the agenda, but the most important one is Ukraine. On the backdrop of the summit, there is a massive buildup of Russian troops along the Ukrainian border. And so President Biden is expected to make a series of diplomatic overtures to President Putin in an effort to de-escalate the situation, basically warning President Putin to stop amassing troops, to not invade Ukraine, a warning of heavy sanctions if Moscow continues with this.
If the sanctions fail and Moscow invades Ukraine, is the U.S. likely to militarily intervene?
So there is definitely no appetite for another war from the American public, and the White House has a very clear understanding of this. Every time reporters ask White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki whether or not the series of options that the White House has in dealing with Moscow includes a military option, the answer is, you know, always very unclear. They're always saying that, you know, sanctions, heavy sanctions, working together with allies, working together with Congress will be the main focus. I mean, they're not saying that anything is off the table, but it's clear that there is very little appetite for any kind of military conflict, especially heading into 2022, which is an election year. There's going to be a midterm elections where Democrats in Congress are trying to keep their slim majority both in the Senate and also in the House of Representatives. So this issue will be a very heavy political issue for President Biden as well as the Democrats, because any kind of reaction will be attacked as either too weak by the Republicans or warmongering by some other parties. So this is a very delicate dance and one of the most difficult calls that President Joe Biden has had to make in his presidency.
Russia is demanding that NATO stop expanding eastward. What has been the White House response to this?
This is the big thing. The main ask that's coming out of President Vladimir Putin is basically Russia does not want Ukraine, which is right on its backyard, to join the Western military alliance of NATO, because they're saying that if there's already too many Balkan countries that have joined NATO and they don't want Ukraine to be another one. And President Joe Biden has responded that he is not going to follow anybody's red lines. And White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki has also said that the ascension of Ukraine into NATO is up to Ukraine and up to NATO, not up to Russia. So, you know, these are some of the heavy issues that's being discussed. I mean, from the Russian point of view, what they're saying is that they're not trying to attack Ukraine, but they're trying to just have a defensive posture because they are trying to protect Moscow from any kind of Western military action, especially if there is military hardware that's being moved by NATO into either Ukraine territory or other Baltic nations that are part of NATO right now.
That's VOA White House Bureau Chief Patsy Widaskuwara speaking with me from Washington. Republican Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell earlier had said President Biden needed to send a strong message to Vladimir Putin.
All must mark a turning point for the Biden administration's approach to major power competition, from one where words are pinned on hopes to one where its words are literally backed by strength.
That's Republican Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke to Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky on Monday ahead of President Joe Biden's call with Russian President Vladimir Putin. State Department spokesman Ned Price told reporters that the United States remains committed to NATO's open-door policy and that the alliance should remain ready to aspirants when they are ready. Ukraine, a former Soviet republic, aspires to join the European Union and NATO.
We've also been clear, and we've heard from our allies, our NATO allies, that we believe there is an opportunity, a window before us, to resolve this diplomatically, chiefly through full implementation of the Minsk agreements, is our priority. That is where we wish to invest our efforts. At the same time, we've been clear that if Moscow shows no interest in investing in a diplomatic off-ramp, that the United States and our partners, and we heard this loud and clear from our NATO allies in Riga last week, that we would be prepared to implement measures that we have not implemented in the past. Specifically, should Russia follow this path of confrontation and military action, we have made clear to Moscow that we will respond resolutely, including with a range of what we have called high-impact economic measures that we've refrained from using in the past. And it's that last clause. We have been clear, as have past administrations of both parties, that NATO has an open door. And we are committed to the open door policy that was put forward in Bucharest, that NATO should remain an option to aspirants when they are ready and able to meet the commitments that are spelled out, as well as the obligations of membership that are spelled out, meaning specifically that they are able and willing to contribute to security in the Euro-Atlantic area.
That's State Department spokesman Ned Price. A Myanmar court sentenced Aung San Suu Kyi to 4 years in jail on Monday. However, Myanmar State TV said her sentence has been reduced to 2 years after a partial pardon. Emma McCarthy of Reuters has more.
A Myanmar court sentenced Aung San Suu Kyi to 4 years jail on Monday. However, Myanmar State TV said her sentence has been reduced to 2 years after a partial pardon. The deposed leader was charged with incitement and breaching COVID-19 restrictions, according to a source. President Win Myint was handed the same sentence, and State TV added they will serve their sentences in a, quote, current detained place, not prison. Critics are dismissing the case as a farce. Amnesty International said the charges against Suu Kyi were bogus and described the jail sentence as the latest example of the military's determination to eliminate all opposition. The two leaders have been detained since the February military coup. The country has been in turmoil since then, paralysed by protests and a deadly crackdown on the junta's opponents. Suu Kyi's supporters say the legal trouble is aimed at ending her political career while the military consolidates power. The military, however, has previously said that Suu Kyi is being given due process in an independent court, led by a judge appointed by her own administration. The trial has been closed to the media, and her lawyers have been barred from communicating with the media and public.
That's Emma McCarthy of Reuters. Defense ministers of Morocco and Israel signed a memorandum of understanding that formalizes security relations between the two countries. It is the first of its kind with an Arab state, although intelligence cooperation has been going on between Israel and some Arab countries. Reporter Angie Omar spoke with Andrew Milburn, former chief of staff of U.S. Special Operations in the Middle East, about what is different in this agreement.
First memorandum of understanding. What is different about this? Here are the key areas. Intelligence sharing has taken place for a long period of time between the Israelis and a number of Arab nations. That's not so much what is new. What is new, it is absolutely comprehensive across the security sector reform. So the Israelis are agreeing to help across the board from training counterinsurgency, but also training, general training. That's a positive sign because it's also linked to kind of an advisory, a mutual collaboration against terrorist threat. The other part about this is both the Israelis and the Moroccans a little bit quiet about this right now, but certainly the door is open to defense industry. The Israelis have talked about establishing a factory for loitering munitions, this type of drone, effective type of drone that the Israelis have used or have provided. These are called suicide drones by the media. But what they are is a precision-guided loitering weapon. So think about this. You've got a bomb, if you like, a flying bomb with camera to locate its target, and it can hang around in the area for a period of time, waiting for a target to show up. And what's interesting about this type of munition, and it's particularly interesting for countries that care about avoiding civilian casualties. So you can target an individual or small group of individuals without harming anyone to either side. So it's tremendously useful in a counterinsurgency fight.
So what does this agreement offer for Israel, and what does Morocco bring to the table for Israel?
Number one is intangible. It's a very mature gesture by both countries. On Israel's part, though, it's not a public relations stunt, but a statement that, look, we are interested globally. We're interested in North Africa. Morocco has been actually a long-term friend of Israel. They collaborated. We're going to get this relationship out in the open, and we're going to formalize it. But it's also a message, a positive message to the United States, that Israel is not just concerned with its own immediate borders, but is willing to be a positive force in other parts of the world. It's a domestic message from the Israeli government to the 750,000 Israelis of Moroccan background. That is important. This is a positive message to them. You are prominent Israeli citizens. We're to have you, etc. Now, the third part, less tangible, it's about money. Well, it's about business, but it's about benefiting both the Moroccan and the Israeli economy. Israeli defense industry has some cutting-edge technologies. Mm-hmm. We mentioned the drones, but also cyber security, but also what we call offensive cyber operations. There's nothing in this MOU that specifically talks about that, but it kind of opens the door for that going ahead.
Would that agreement lead to more cooperation between Morocco and Israel in combating terrorism in Africa?
I would hope so. And again, security can only be a force for the good. Even France, downscaling in Mali, and Macron just earlier this year talking about reducing operational Barkhane and pulling troops. The United States has already pulled U.S. forces out of Somalia and out of Niger. So from the viewpoint of both Morocco and Israel, a stable Africa is better for overall security. There's no place where groups like, on one hand, Hezbollah or the traditional jihadi can find succor. But there's also an element of resources. Africa is rich in resources. And the third part is, from a point of view of markets, we talked about defense industries, talked about various other services Israel can offer Africa and Morocco, perhaps in combination. Africa's a great market.
That was Andrew Milburn, former chief of staff of U.S. Special Operations in the Middle East, speaking with journalist Angie Omar. More than 5 million people worldwide have had their lives cut short by COVID-19, and the number keeps rising. The best defense against this virus is a vaccine. VOA's Carol Pearson explains one approach in making a vaccine that's been effective against polio, measles, Ebola, and a host of other viruses.
People can get COVID-19 even though they've been fully vaccinated, but that doesn't mean the vaccine has failed. Those who are fully vaccinated against this virus are so far much less likely to end up in a hospital or on a ventilator. Dr. Andrea Cox with Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine has a special interest in immunology.
The goal of vaccination is to reduce the severity of disease in almost all vaccines in use and not to prevent infection entirely.
The oldest method to make a vaccine uses either a live virus that is too weak to reproduce. Scientists call it a live attenuated virus, or a dead virus that, because it is dead, can't reproduce, but can still cause an immune response. Polio vaccines have used both dead and weakened live polioviruses with great success. Many countries are now polio-free. In 2021, only 2 children in the entire world contracted the wild poliovirus. 3 COVID-19 vaccines use weakened adenoviruses, benign viruses that cause colds, as their vectors. Vectors are simply delivery systems used to introduce a more dangerous virus, either a weakened live virus or a dead one, or a portion of that virus. The Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine uses a weakened chimpanzee adenovirus that does not infect humans. Sputnik V and the Johnson & Johnson vaccines use weakened human adenoviruses. With all 3 vaccines, scientists remove a gene from the coronavirus's spike protein and put it into the adenoviruses. Once injected, the viruses enter the cells and start to produce the spike protein. Then the body mounts an attack. Remember, the spike protein is only a part of the coronavirus and doesn't cause COVID-19, so there's no danger of getting the illness from the vaccine. Again, Dr. Cox.
You don't just mount an immune response to the adenovirus, but you also mount the immune response to the protein that it encodes, that spike protein that is part of the virus causing COVID.
The World Health Organization has authorized use of the AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson vaccines, but not Sputnik V. The WHO says it needs more data from the Sputnik trials. Cox says of the three vaccines that use an adenovirus, scientists favor the AstraZeneca and the Johnson & Johnson vaccines.
We know the most about the AstraZeneca and the Johnson & Johnson vaccines because they have been given to tens of millions, if not 100 million people worldwide. So we know the most about their side effect profiles and their immune responses. We have far less data on the Sputnik vaccine because it has just been used far less frequently, and there are simply fewer international studies that have assessed it.
While some people choose not to get a vaccine, others are willing to travel long distances to get one. Hondurans are willing to cross a river to get the vaccine in neighboring Nicaragua. The pandemic is far from over. Some scientists expect COVID to be with us for 3 to 4 years. And even with the best scientists in the world working on vaccines and treatments, doctors are concerned that as the virus continues to infect unvaccinated people and mutate, at some point, the vaccines we have now won't be able to offer full protection against COVID-19. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
This is the Voice of America. China has accused the United States of violating the Olympic spirit after the Biden administration announced a diplomatic boycott of the Beijing Winter Games over its human rights concerns. Rights groups have pushed for a full-blown boycott of the Games, accusing China of rights abuses against ethnic minorities. The U.S. decision falls short of those calls, but comes at an exceptionally turbulent time for the relations between the powerhouse nations. It was met with a barrage of criticism from China on Tuesday. A foreign ministry spokesperson said the U.S. is attempting to interfere with the Beijing Games, quote, out of ideological prejudice and based on lies and rumors, unquote. A whistleblower has alleged that Britain's foreign office abandoned many of the nation's allies in Afghanistan and left them to the mercy of the Taliban during the fall of the capital, Kabul, because of a dysfunctional and arbitrary evacuation effort. In evidence to a parliamentary committee, Raphael Marshall said thousands of pleas for help via emails were unread between August 21st and August 25th. The former Foreign Office employee estimated that only 5% of Afghan nationals who applied to flee under one UK program received help. He said he was the only person monitoring the inbox at one point. You are listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. The World Health Organization reports a significant rise in malaria cases and deaths in 2020 due to COVID-19 disruptions in malaria services. Lisa Schneider reports for VOA from Geneva on WHO's latest World Malaria Report.
Over the past two decades, global malaria death rates have been cut in half, saving the lives of 10.6 million people. New data gathered by the WHO show COVID-19 has stopped and even reversed the progress made in reducing deaths from this preventable, treatable disease. The WHO's World Malaria Report estimates 241 million malaria cases and 627,000 malaria deaths globally have occurred in 2020. This represents an increase of 14 million cases and 69,000 deaths compared to the previous year. WHO links the increase to disruptions of malaria prevention, diagnosis, and treatment services during the pandemic. Director of WHO's Global Malaria Program, Pedro Alonso, says the situation could have been far worse. The good news, he says, is that the predicted doomsday scenario did not transpire. He notes gloomy projections made in March 2020 of a huge spike in malaria have not materialized.
One worst case scenario, you implied a doubling of malaria deaths. So let me reiterate this. That is not the case. We can call this a success story, even though an extra 47,000 people have died as a consequence of the disruptions.
The report finds progress in the global fight against malaria remains uneven. Between 2000 and 2020, WHO has certified 12 countries as being malaria-free. Two countries, China and El Salvador, have achieved this status in 2021, despite the ongoing pandemic. Since 2015, both cases and deaths have stalled in most of the world's 93 endemic countries and territories. However, other figures show malaria cases have increased in 32 countries, most in sub-Saharan Africa and some in South America. Alonso says the situation remains especially precarious in Africa, where the malaria burden remains unacceptably high. He notes Africa accounts for about 96% of global deaths, 80% among children under age 5.
And at the same time, the pandemic is not over, and the pace of economic recovery is uncertain. Without immediate and accelerated action, key 2030 targets of the WHO Global Technical Strategy will be missed, and additional ground may be lost.
WHO strategy calls for a 90% reduction in malaria cases and deaths by 2030. It also presses for the elimination of malaria in at least 35 countries and for the prevention of disease resurgence in all countries that are malaria-free. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The European Union drug regulator has given its backing to mixing different types of vaccines in initial vaccination and booster campaigns to battle the coronavirus. The European Medicines Agency said in a statement Tuesday that using different types of vaccines together, known as heterologous vaccination, can provide protection against COVID-19. The announcement comes as much of Europe is facing rising infection and hospital rates and concerns about a new Omicron variant. The EMA, along with the European Center for Disease Control, said that a mix and match strategy could give nations more options in vaccination campaigns as much of the continent faces rising infections and hospitalization rates. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Marco Yavaro, and our managing editor, Kate Pound Dawson, I am Chin Edwapo in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a pleasant evening.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. and it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 0905